Hello, beloved listeners. Welcome to another week of the Little Wireless Program. I'm just reading a tweet here from me. Is it potty to think pot plants can change the plot on climate change? Pop along to LNL. Well, I know it sounds nuts, but you'll be meeting a friend of mine shortly who will be putting it to you in all seriousness as a part of a somewhat larger set of ideas, and I think you'll find it intriguing. Our main story, too, will be an environmental one, a climate change story, if we manage to track down our guests. So let me set it up by reminding you that this program has been nagging listeners about climate change for decades. And I have to say that we've looked at China very, very often. Old friends of mine in the climate change climate change issue, like Tim Flannery, like Professor Ian Lowe, have come on the program to argue a case for China. They point out that yes, it's undoubtedly the world's largest investor in green energy. On the other hand, of course, it's also the world's largest burner of coal. Not that we can strike sanctimonious attitudes on that issue, given that we export such a lot of that nasty stuff and are continuing to export more and more and more in what looks like a last-minute export panic to rake the money in before global attitudes to coal change absolutely and fundamentally. Well, tonight, barring accident, I'll be talking to a couple of people with slightly different views on China. One of them is Craig Simons. Craig's written a book called The Devouring Dragon, How China's Rise Threatens the Natural World. And the other is Jennifer Turner, who's been on the program a few times. She's the director of the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and will be, we trust. Oh, we found her. She's in the ABC's Washington studio, but there's a hiccup, so I'll be talking to her on the blower. So let's start with you, Jennifer. You're just back from China. I'll get you to tell me more about what you were doing there in a bit. But while you were there, you saw, quote, the engine of China. Can you describe that rather smelly engine?
Yes. I was in China putting on a research exchange, bringing U.S. and Chinese water and energy experts together to look at how China can start resolving their water energy conflicts. And the biggest conflict is between coal and water, because coal is a very water-intensive form of energy. And after we did these meetings in Beijing, which is all good and fine, I thought, let's take the people out to see the coal, because we always think of coal in abstract, right? China's coal use has doubled between 2000 and 2007. It's going to double again. But has anyone really seen it, right? So we went out to the Wuhai city, which is in Inner Mongolia. That's China's number one coal-producing region. It has about 26% of their coal, but only about 1.6% of their water. And we were met with a truly a moonscape. I mean, if the moon was made of coal and black. It's one of the most polluted cities in China. It's not that big, 500,000, but the city's really a coal complex. You've got mining, coal processing, coal to chemicals, coal to liquid industries, and it's all clustered together on a grand scale. I mean, and we drove for miles and miles and miles, and you just saw open coal pits and the factories and the coal-fired power plants, and I was really struck with these mountains that were built out of the coal mine tailings. And about China, this city, this area produced about 10% of China's coal, and it's but one of five existing coal power bases in China.
You were saying that while your jaw dropped at the scale, you were in fact visiting a comparatively small coal base.
It was a very small coal base, and it's one of the older ones. And then as comparison, we thought we'd hop across the Yellow River. We drove in a great bumpy van, and we went to the Ningdong coal base in Ningxia province, and we saw this very modern, coal base, and we jokingly called this the coal safari, because we were just driving along roads and just seeing these, they were skyscraper high coal to liquids plants, right, to make gas, coal-fired power plants and coal to chemical plants, and it was very clean and modern and was much cleaner than Wuhai. But you have to keep in the back of your mind that this form of, you know, particularly the coal to chemicals and coal to liquid industries, they use a lot of water. A lot of water. And the government's planning to build 16 more large-scale coal bases. And it's meant to be, you know, economies of scale, that they can mine it and have the coal-fired power plants at the mouth of the mines, and they built these huge transmission lines to transfer the electricity to the coast.
Now, I have to remind you, Jennifer, that you're talking to a country where this is not uncommon. I live in the Upper Hunter of New South Wales. And we, every night when I drive back to the farm, I drive through countless miles of coal mines and then plonked here and there, glowing in the night, often looking quite magnificent at the power stations. But we, of course, while we are gross polluters, particularly in other people's countries, we've got to remember that China has a fifth of the world's population, that it produces a quarter of global greenhouse emissions. And as you were pointing out, it burns almost half the coal on Earth.
On the planet. And the electricity, keep in mind, too, that 25% of their electricity is for export products. So when I was in Wuhai, in one of the engines, I couldn't help but think that this is my engine, too. You know, we consume the products from the electricity that came from this coal. 70% of China's electricity is from coal. So it's not just that, you know, China is responsible for a growing amount of greenhouse gas emissions, but a lot of it is, you know, linked to the products that we ourselves are consuming outside of China.
Our other eagle has landed. We now have Craig Simons as well, the author of The Devouring Dragon. Good title, Craig. We'll be talking about various aspects of coal and other issues, but paraphrasing from your book, let us remind the listener that we're talking about the only large economy that has ever had such a sustained growth rate. It's running at, over three decades, 10% a year.
Yeah, roughly. That's right. I'm glad to be here as well. And hello, Jennifer. It's really, for me, you know, I started off as a teacher in China in the mid-90s, and then I became a journalist and wrote this book sort of at the end of a decade of covering China and then covering Asia. And really the story of China is one of tremendous growth and tremendous scale. You know, it's 1.3 billion people growing at that 10% annual rate for nearly three decades. It's a bit slower now, partly because of the global slowdown economically, but because of the size of China, really its consumer demands are just rising exponentially.
And as you say, China is just hitting its stride as the planet is reaching its tipping point.
That's part of what really drove me to write this book. You know, scientists have talked about the inability of the planet to sustain an ever-growing population, both growing in numbers and growing in its demands for a long time. I mean, back even into the 19th century with Thomas Malthus. But what we're really seeing now is, you know, China coming along with 1.3 billion, and then behind China there's India and Brazil and the rest. I had sort of two metaphors that I used when I was thinking about the book. The first is that China is raising our global metabolism, that we really are sort of upping the global rate of environmental change. And the second is that we have this second great wave of environmental change. The first was really caused by the United States and Europe and Australia and Japan and the rest. But now we have this much larger second wave, which is, you know, the BRIC countries, and it's going to really have a huge impact.
It's not the purpose of your book, of course, to condemn China or to cast it into outer darkness. You just recognize the paradox of the position it's in.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was interested in doing a couple of things. One is documenting how China has surpassed the United States in its environmental impacts globally. And then beyond that, I wanted to fit China into that longer global narrative of environmental change. That I think, you know, we really, if we go around pointing fingers, the Chinese rightfully can point one right back and say, well, you guys did the same kind of thing as you got wealthy, and why can, you know, how can you say that we can't do this now? So for me, it's a story of global responsibility and thinking about environmental change in a new way.
Jennifer, China is trying, well, quite desperately, to get things into balance. But as both of you would point out, is it too little, or as both of you would ask, is it too little too late?
Well, I think that I'm glad you asked that. I mean, that, you know, the Chinese government has been investing massively into clean energy technologies, really had an aggressive program to decrease the country's energy intensity, and China has become a kind of laboratory for developing and deploying this clean energy technology, because they have the policies, the investment, and, you know, it's encouraging the business. And there are, you know, from the U.S. side, you know, there's an increasing number of U.S. and Chinese businesses that are trying to cooperate on clean energy issues. But still, the rate of their electricity growth, it almost, I don't want to say it nullifies it, but it's still, I mean, by 2020, coal will still be 70% of their electricity.
Craig, I heard you trying to come back in.
No, I think those are all very good points. I mean, I always, when in my book, I dealt with the same question, this paradox that China, you know, if you read in the media, China often gets presented as either, you know, sort of a great sort of global destroyer of the environment, or as the global redeemer, you know, that China is creating a green energy kind of future for us all. I mean, I think that we can have both things happening at once. You know,
yeah.
China, just by the dint of its size and the scale of its, you know, this growth, it's, you know, it's both emitting something like 30%, 29% of carbon emissions now, and its energy demands are probably going to double, or may double, over the next two or three decades. At the same time, they are the world's largest market for clean energy finance and investment. You know, they're building a lot of clean energy wind fields and solar fields and everything else.
Ellen Neal on RN, and my guest, Jennifer Turner. This is, I think, the third time Jennifer's joined me. Jennifer's from the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Craig Simons is the author of The Devouring Dragon. Jennifer, a lot of the research and advocacy work you've done is about linking the US and China to demonstrate the problems they share.
Yes, I mean definitely. That I mean, the US, you know, we were the first energy hog in the world, and we still, I mean, per capita, we still use much more energy than the Chinese public. And I think that there are opportunities, and there's, you know, we've had some difficulties in the last few years because of China accused of dumping cheap solar PV panels in the United States. And it's really sad to see that, oh dear, clean energy has become another issue for the U.S. and China to tussle about. But I think we may be starting to get beyond that. I mean, what's intriguing is that another form of energy that is controversial in the United States is shale gas fracturing. That, you know, U.S. and China have a shale gas, you know, there's a bilateral initiative to cooperate, and our two industries are cooperating. China's actually investing increasingly in shale gas in the United States as well.
At any moment now, Jennifer, you'll have CSG being drilled for in Central Park, I would think.
Yeah. But there's also, besides the bilateral government and business cooperation, a lot of the U.S. Environmental and non-governmental organizations are active in China in working on clean energy issues. And what I've been excited about, not to brag, but our Choke Point China work, this looked at how energy development is impacting water in China, particularly the coal story, is that we've sparked U.S. and Chinese NGOs and researchers to start looking at how is coal really impacting water. Because, I mean, while it's all good that they're doing all this investment, China is also really poor at enforcing pollution control technologies. I mean, Wuhai, a lot of these coal-fired power plants, and they have the clean energy technology, but they don't turn them on. And, I mean, we have some photos online that show you some of this. I mean, it's incredibly polluted, and that the challenge is often that, you know, local governments, their incentive is to make money. And we see this, you know, all across China, that they want to make money so they don't turn on the air pollution emission technology or wastewater treatment plants.
Craig, I want to change the topic quite abruptly and talk about wood, timber, because what's happening there shows us how China is denuding itself of natural resources, but of course denuding other places as well.
Timber. You know, it's an interesting story for me. I looked at wildlife, timber, and climate change as the main areas in my book. with timber, you can really see a moment where China began to seek, you know, seek imported wood. So in 1998, there were some bad floods on the Yangtze, killing hundreds of people, costing billions of dollars in damages. And the government decided to ban logging across much of China. So actually in China, they've been replanting areas of forest, partly to save the rivers or to help degrade it, you know, to help against erosion and whatnot. So as a result of that, China's demand has pushed outward, and even at the same time, China's demand for timber products has grown tremendously. So one of the big numbers I highlighted in the book was that China now imports nearly half of all the world's traded tropical logs and pulp made from tropical logs. I think the United States still imports more wood products, but a lot of it comes from places like Canada, where it's more sustainably harvested. A lot of the stuff going into China now is coming from places like Papua New Guinea, which I went to for my book. 90 to 95% of timber of logs that are exported out of Papua New Guinea end up in China, and some of the scientists there believe that at least the lowland forest could be gone within a few decades.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of broadcasts out of the region, particularly in places like Solomon Islands, where, you know, the devastation of the forest is breathtaking. East Timor, I think, is teetering on the brink, and as you say, PNG's got its problems. Jennifer, are Chinese policymakers aware of the fact? Do they feel any guilt for their predations in the wider world?
That's a tough question. I think that, in terms of, like, if you're talking timber, and we can even toss in, illegal wildlife trade, I mean, the Chinese government has made lots of steps to try to address, I know, the illegal animal trade and somewhat on the timber, but it's often very complex, these connections, that sometimes it's not even the Chinese themselves importing it directly, that you have examples of Japanese and European companies in Laos, that they harvest the trees and ship them to their factories in China. So it's fairly difficult. I mean, they have, China does sign a lot of international agreements on, sustainable harvesting. They have they've been working with the forest, FCS, to try to have kind of a certificate for sustainably harvested wood. But it's slow going. I think Craig knows more about that as well.
Craig, do you know anywhere in China where they're getting the balance right? Say that, the particular issue of coal versus water. Are there any model areas where progressive policies are being successfully initiated?
Well, certainly there are places in China that are considered model communities where they're trying to get those balances right. They're trying to clean up the air and clean up the water. It's been difficult. I mean, partly what I look at in the book is China's tradition of a top-down Confucian model. I mean, this is 2,000 years of political philosophy that really has led to a stymied civil society. So there's not, the journalists are not able to run around and catch the polluters, and there's not the same kind of NGO impetus for stopping pollution and whatnot. So it's really difficult for China from the top to dictate that people are going to protect the environment. It's like Jennifer mentioned earlier, there's a lot of this, you can put in the pollution, the mechanics to catch the pollutants at the source, but often they're not even turned on. So I think in China it's probably hard to point to one particular area and say they're getting everything right.
Jennifer, that's another paradox about China, of course. A very powerful central government, but it's unable to impose its authority on vast tracts of the country.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, the central government, I mean, they're talking much more and investing into energy and environmental issues, still, I mean, party and government members, their main criteria for promotion is economic growth. And economic growth is what is really promotes stability in China. And the Chinese public, long pent-up consumerism, it's coming out. And that said, I mean, the per capita consumption of resources in China is still quite low. It's that big population that kind of skews it all. And even the public's awareness of, their own footprint globally is not that great. But that's some ways that's a global problem. You know, how do we know what our own personal footprint is around the world?
Jennifer, in my country, in fact in my part of New South Wales, the fight between coal and water is intense and strident. But on every time government makes a decision, it's in favour of coal and averts its eyes from the water crisis. But as you point out, China has such minimal water supplies per capita, its water resources are only one quarter of the world average.
Yes, and that's a big part of our work, looking at how this water energy crunch, how, you know, it could very well be, you know, motivating creative change, but then not. For example, North China is very dry. They need to get water to the coal, so they have this massive south to north water transfer project, moving water from the Yangtze River to the north, supply side oriented mentality, because that's what the Chinese government does well, right? You can mobilize your engineers to build this. But this water transfer itself is very energy intensive. I haven't yet found someone who knows how much, you know, the pumping, the cleaning of the water, and even building it costs in terms of electricity, but I've kind of sparked the interest of some researchers. China is also making huge investments into desalinating water to supply their cities, and you know, even pondering that, you know, pumping this water to help to the coal regions.
Jennifer, about recycling plans? Are they doing much of that?
Yeah, I mean, northern China, Beijing is probably the leader in terms of recycling. It's mainly in the city center, and by 2015, they will be recycling almost 100% of their water. It's still something that needs to be done on a grander scale, but as China hits these, you know, more and more of these water crunches, I mean, Chinese cities are running out of water, and even moving the water from the south to the north, the water's dirty and you have to clean it. So I think that we're going to, you know, as Craig said at the beginning, you know, that there is a tipping point happening in China, and they're starting to see that the cost, you know, both with energy and water, of not better managing their resources, it's going to become too great. And so we should be seeing more water recycling. The 12th five-year plan required all industries to improve their water efficiency by 30% as well. And, you know, northern Chinese companies, steel plants already do that because they haven't had water. But it's kind of a race, right? You know, can China become efficient fast enough? And I'm always apologetic to my Chinese friends when I say, look, you guys have to be the most energy and water efficient country in the world because you have no choice. Your pressure on these resources is so great.
What do you reckon, Craig? Is it going to happen, or is it, as we were saying earlier, too little, too late?
I think it'll happen at some point. I mean, the question is, you know, I've heard this question framed in different ways in the past. You know, I think it's not an either or. We have a real variety of potential outcomes, and you know, I think, you know, both within China, there's going to be more degradation, obviously, but globally as well, there's going to be more degradation. The question is when will China be able to figure it out, and globally, when will we be able to come to some kind of consensus to deal with these problems and deal with them in a sustainable way.
Well, going back to the engine symbol that Jennifer employed, Craig, you talk about the other engines around the world, Brazil, India. You know, there's a huge number of countries trying to gallop ahead, and all of them will have this same crisis. If China can solve some of the problems, it would be a very useful test bench for the rest of us.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the things that are happening in China are both warnings, but they're also, I mean, the potential for dealing with these problems has, you know, it could give us solutions that we could use in other places. I think one thing that listeners, you know, keep in mind and people should think about is China's relative poverty. You know, we have all of these problems in China at the same time. The average, I wrote my book in 2011, 2012, so the 2011 numbers, China's per capita GDP was somewhere around $4,500, about a tenth of the U.S. per capita average. So the people are still relatively poor. I mean, that money is also not equitably distributed. You have a lot of people living on a couple dollars a day. Those people want to have some of the material goods that we're used to in the West. I mean, these are people who have never owned a motor vehicle, never flown on a plane, may never have visited even a nearby city. So for them, the opportunity to go and travel somewhere is tremendous. I mean, they, you know, the idea of flying on a plane for the first time and looking down at the world, you know, we're, it's to us, maybe it's ho-hum. To them, it's the first opportunity. And it's understandable why they want these things. The question is, can we find ways to produce the energy and to produce the material goods that will satisfy those desires in a way that's sustainable?
I've been flying for 60 years and I still look out the window in wonderment and disbelief. Jennifer, a final question to you, or a comment. There's been a drought in the south, and that presents problems for hydropower, you know, and therefore the available of electricity.
Exactly. And in the past 3 years, China's had about 5 major droughts in the south, and they've embarked on a new wave of putting in more hydropower dams. Again, that's the other engine in China, hydropower. And already it doesn't seem logical when already a lot of the existing hydropower plants, their reservoirs it gets low and they're not able to transfer enough electricity. And you also have examples where in Yunnan province that instead of one, you know, they send a lot of their electricity out from their hydro, and they're starting to build more energy-intensive industries because they also want to tap that. And because Yunnan is also one of the poorest provinces in China. And like Craig said, they want to build up their own economy. And it's hard to understand, but hydro, this is another example of, you know, local governments often benefit from this investment and sale of electricity. So the incentives are often a bit skewed, and it's promoting
Jennifer,
unsustainable electricity.
A great performance. I've got to wind it up. Thank you, Jennifer Turner from the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and you, Craig Simons, of the author of The Devouring Dragon. Now we can solve all these problems with a pop plant. Keep listening to LNL.